Okay, my chapter was on Japan, and in the interest of time, I just wanted to highlight three themes in my chapter and bring it up to date. The first theme is about Prime Minister Abe and what I would call his historical nationalism and his political pragmatism. And when the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II took place in Japan, much of the focus, quite understandably, was on Prime Minister Abe's statement about the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. Now, as many of you in this audience may know, I have always been quite critical of Prime Minister Abe's views on history, the way he has downplayed Japanese wartime atrocities, his ambivalence regarding Japan's war responsibility, and also his efforts to try to rescind the Kono statement of apology regarding comfort women. So when Prime Minister Abe, after becoming Prime Minister again, stated that he wanted to issue a new statement about the end of World War II, I joined many of my colleagues in expressing quite a bit of concern that this could end up becoming a political and diplomatic disaster for Japan. And my fear was that he would use this statement to dilute, if not completely nullify, the 1995 Murayama statement, which had become the gold standard for Japan's official apology and acknowledgement for its transgressions in World War II. In my chapter, I detail quite a bit of the discussion to lead up of the Abe statement, and there was a lot of press coverage about this, and many liberal-leaning intellectuals and journalists mentioned that it was absolutely imperative that Mr. Abe talk about apology, talk about aggression, talk about colonization. Now, what emerged on August 14th, 2015 was a incredibly shrewd and skillfully put together statement that balanced two imperatives. One was to stay true to his views about history and to be responsive to his nationalistic constituency, and on the other hand, to avoid a diplomatic crisis not only with Japan's Asian neighbors, but foremostly with that of the United States. And although some of parts of the statement are quite awkward and is quite lengthy, it is an amazing piece of work. And what he instilled in that statement was a sense of emotional content, where he talked about the personal pain that he had, and he expressed gratitude for many in the international community who embraced Japan after World War II and supported reconciliation. But he stopped short of explicitly acknowledging Japan's wartime aggression. He talked about apologies, but he never himself expressed an apology on behalf of Japan. I think my good friend, Professor Tanaka Akihiko, who's now the president of the Graduate Research Institute for Policy Studies, summed it up best when he said, "It's not that the Abe statement satisfied anyone, but the important point is that it did not dissatisfy anyone completely." And so what he basically did was to balance things, and he was essentially politically pragmatic. And so although he did not move forward the process of reconciliation, he avoided diplomatic disaster. And I would say to this day that kind of political pragmatism still is in force. As you know, on December 2013, Prime Minister Abe provoked a diplomatic crisis because he went to the Yasukuni Shrine as Prime Minister. But since then, he has avoided going to the Yasukuni Shrine. And in the last 2 years, 2017 and 2018, on August the 15th, no member of the Abe cabinet has gone to the Yasukuni Shrine, which is a remarkable thing. This is the first time in an LDP government since 1985 that a Japanese cabinet minister in an LDP government has not gone to the Yasukuni Shrine. There were two other times after 1985 that Japanese cabinet members did not go to the Yasukuni Shrine, and both of those occasions was when the Democratic Party of Japan was in power. And I would probably go a little bit further than Professor Young in terms of the state of Sino-Japanese relations. What is remarkable to me is how much Japan's relations with China has improved over the last 2 years. And there is a lot of international politics involved, especially the American factor, the importance of the Japanese economy to China's economic interests. But there's also been mutual restraint on the part of the Chinese leadership and even on Abe. And so there's been a de facto ceasefire in the so-called memory wars between Japan and China. The second theme is that about political contestation about memory. Abe was pragmatic, but he papered over differences, a deep divide in the Japanese polity about war memory and what it means. He papered over these differences and he did not resolve that debate. And the persistence of this political divide was became quite evident to me when I was in Japan a couple weeks ago. And on August 15th, I was in Tokyo. And that's the, you know, the anniversary of the end of World War II. And first I visited Chidori Gafuji, which is the war memorial where the remains of the unknown dead are honored. And there, there was a very solemn ceremony in which many of the leaders of Japan's anti-war and pacifist movement was there, expressing not only the grief over the losses of war, but emphasizing the lessons that Japan learned from that wartime experience. After that, a few blocks away, I went to the Yasukuni Shrine, and there was a completely different narrative, and it was quite a festive atmosphere with many right-wing groups, and some of my friends from the Nihon Kaigi had a major kind of public meeting and arguing for the renovation of Japan and hoping that the constitution ought to be revised. It just impressed upon me how different the narratives were. Now, it does not mean that there isn't an implicit consensus about memory in Japan. I think that there is one. And it's evident on the annual anniversaries that are marked in Japan. And it starts out with the anniversary for the Battle of Okinawa in June, and then with the Hiroshima and Nagasaki memorial services, and finally the August 15 Budokan ceremony, in which both the Emperor and the Prime Minister always attend. And here, you know, I think is the kind of the foundation for a national consensus on war memory. But unfortunately, Japanese political figures have been unable to tap into that to develop a consensus that would weave together both the victim and perpetrator narrative on behalf of a positive view about history and learning from history. The third theme, the final theme, is about the role of the emperor. Now, I always felt that the fact that the emperor did not take personal responsibility for war was a major problem in post-war Japanese history. But it's undeniable that the current emperor, who will abdicate this coming year, has played a key role in shaping the narrative. On January 1st, 2015, the year in which Abe said he was going to come up with a new statement, he opened the new year saying that the Japanese must always remember and learn from history, starting with 1931, when the Manchurian incident took place, in thinking about the future course of that country, of Japan as a country. And that basically established the parameters for Abe's statement. Again, on August 15th of this year, the emperor went and to the Budokan ceremony and talked about, he used the term fukaku hansei tsuru, which I think the Japanese Foreign Ministry has translated as deep remorse. It could be between deep remorse and deep reflection, but basically enunciating the point that the Japanese must always remember and learn from history. Now, the interesting thing is in the Abe statement itself, there are in fact two paragraphs in which Abe talks about remembering history and passing this on to future generations. The unfortunate thing is that under the Abe cabinet, he really has not acted upon that statement in his 70th anniversary statement. And I fear that it will only be in a post-Abe government in which such actions might emerge. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm to talk about Taiwan and in this war ending anniversary issue. Basically, I'm looking at three different types of things. I'm going to look at an overall theme. And the theme is basically looking at Taiwan and its complicated internal situation, trying to, different components, particularly the government, trying to find the right balance in dealing with what they found was strong influence pressure from China to given the assertiveness that has been talked about already and the amount of emphasis they put on this anniversary and the parade and so forth, to align with, for the ROC in Taiwan, to align with China in this endeavor. And then I'm going to look at some developments that took place, and it's a complicated situation. And then I'll look at some implications, taking this up to the present, and how the Taiwan people in Taiwan are, how they have balanced, how they balanced in 2015, and how they're balanced, their balancing act, and looking at the situation today. I see four elements of influence when we're looking at the setting of the situation. The first and probably the most important one is the PRC, is Beijing. It was, this is under Xi Jinping. They're very assertive in a whole range of ways during this period. And they showed this, of course, in the East China Sea and the South China Sea at this time, which is very relevant to Taiwan because Taiwan has the same claims as Beijing, and Beijing wanted Taiwan to line up with them, to support them, and mutually support in this effort. In the case of the East China Sea, that would be against Japan. In the case of the South China Sea, it would be against the other claimants in the South China Sea. And so the anniversary episodes took place in this context of China seeking this kind of support from Taiwan. In Taiwan, you had a KMT government of Ma Ying-jeou who had a policy of trying to accommodate China, but it wasn't too popular. He had lost, his party had lost island-wide elections in late 2014, and it didn't look so good for the KMT going into the elections that were going to take place in 2016 to elect a whole new government, including at the end of Ma Ying-jeou's presidency. And so, under these circumstances, the President Ma of the KMT had to maneuver so that he had enough support in Taiwan, he didn't damage the KMT in Taiwan, but at the same time, that he had to deal with the pressures that he was feeling from Beijing. And the pressures were pretty important. Other elements, the third element that I consider is the opposition forces at that time, the DPP, Democratic Progressive Party, the so-called Pan-Green forces. The KMT is known as the Pan-Blue forces in Taiwan. And many of their cohorts, of course, are people who, the older generation in particular, see that the Japanese really weren't the enemy at all from their point of view, and that the real enemy they faced, at least a much worse occupation from them, carried out by the KMT after they arrived in 1945. And so these folks had a very different view of Japan. They're much more sympathetic to Japan. And so the idea of commemorating this war seemed to be pretty remote and not very, didn't get much support. In addition, this issue is compounded by the fact that public opinion in Taiwan, whether KMT or Pan Blue or Pan Green, was becoming more anxious about Beijing's pressures on a whole range of issues. And they were worried about domination. And so Ma's approach to Beijing wasn't quite as, didn't get as much support as it used to, his accommodating approach. And so this is the dynamics inside Taiwan were moving in that direction at this time. And then outside of that, of course, you have Japan. And Japan is backed by the United States. And on the islands issue, the United States, under President Obama, not prone to being very obstreperous, as we know, but he takes a strong view on this and supports the alliance with Japan and its claims and its coverage of the Japanese-controlled islands in the Senkaku Kyaku Islands. And so, and of course, the opinion in Japan and in Taiwan about Japan, as I said, is very mixed, with the KMT being a bit more wary of Japan, and the Pan-Green being very positive toward Japan. So these, it's complicated. And to simplify it, I'd like to focus a bit on the pressure of Beijing, the Xi Jinping approach, which was I think, the most important element here. In any event, I think we know about the prelude leading up to the anniversary were the years where, under Xi Jinping, the Chinese government took a very assertive position dealing with East China Sea Islands and dealing with the South China Sea Islands, among other things. And he pressed Taiwan to join them. In other words, because Taiwan had the same claims and articulated the same claims, but they wanted to do it jointly. And Ma Ying-jeou was very careful to avoid that. He didn't want to be seen as the ally of Beijing in this kind of assertive approach. He took a differentiated approach. He came up with a new initiative, he called it, in the East China Sea in 2013, which opened the way for a fishing agreement with Japan over the East China Sea Islands, something that China wasn't open to at all at that particular time. And in the South China Sea, too, he reiterated the claim, but at the same time, he came up with a South China Sea initiative in 2015. And again, separating himself from Beijing and not endorsing Beijing's approach. But when we get into the war memory issue, then we find the KMT is the party of the ROC that was in power during the war against Japan. And so the veterans have to be acknowledged. This is their government that did this. They feel that they did the fighting. They did the main fighting in dealing with the Japanese. in this war, and therefore they felt they should commemorate this. And of course, Beijing up to this point had been very reluctant to acknowledge that the ROC played much of a role in this sort of thing. They said the communists were the main reason why the Japanese were defeated in China. And so this caused a lot of problems between the Myeongjo government and the Chinese and how they interpreted it. Over the course of this memory issue, the PRC started to adjust its policy. And it acknowledged, eventually, that the ROC forces did play a role in against the Japanese. And they encouraged ROC veterans to come to China for this parade, for these celebrations that they wanted to have. The Myeongjo government said, and their spokesperson, Ma himself said this, and the spokesperson said, this is unjust to us. We are the ones who actually carried out the victory, and Beijing is using this for their own means. And so they took a dim view of this. And so you can see how Ma was positioning himself, because obviously there's a whole sentiment in Taiwan that doesn't like this at all. And that sentiment, part of it was acknowledged, was noted by Lee Teng-hui, the former president, KMT leader, but very pro-Japanese. And he reflected this strong approval of Japan, how this issue was in the past, we should put it aside, not worry about it very much, and so forth. Well, Ma very strongly criticized Lee Teng-hui. On the other hand, Lee's former vice president, Lien Zhan, he's a KMT stalwart, still is, he advocated closer relations with Beijing, and he went to the parade. And so it was a very sort of complicated situation, as you can see. Now, the DPP, the leaders, and Tsai Ing-wen, their leader, played a fairly low-key role in this situation. And they were more sympathetic with Lee Teng-hui. And they weren't that critical of Lee Teng-hui at all in what he was saying about the Japanese. But again, the main commemoration efforts focused on the KMT efforts to acknowledge the veterans. They had their own separate parade in July, a big affair by Taiwan standards, but like nothing like what happened in Beijing. And unfortunately, Beijing's message gets mixed up. And so right at the time that they were doing all this, building these relationships and so forth, news came out that there was this documentary about a big exercise in the PRC. PRC forces were practicing. And what were they practicing? They were practicing an assault on this building in the background. And if any of you have been, many of you have been to Taipei, and the presidential palace of Taipei is a unique building. You know, it has this 19th century style to it. And there it was. They were practicing attacking the palace of the president of Taiwan. And so in Taiwan, that didn't go down very well. And so Beijing just has, it's hard to get its act together sometimes. So in any event, they went through all of this, and Myeongjo kept his separate position, and the anniversary passed. And so looking out for the implications of this, what you find is that you have a Taiwan identity, but it's this collection of these different forces, and it changes over time. But it's a fairly strong identity. And what's happening in Taiwan, this identity was moving against Beijing. It was resenting their pressures and moving against Beijing. And so, what happens is Myeongjo's accommodating approach is sort of discredited in the elections of January 2016. Tsai Ing-wen is elected by a landslide, the legislature changes, and the DPP is in control both of the presidency and the legislature. And this is a big setback for Beijing, and its assertiveness. And yet, what does Beijing do? What's the answer? If it doesn't work, it's like my father. When he dealt with a problem and he had a hammer, he would just hammer more, you see? And so the upshot is that Beijing hammers more and of course, it has some effect on Taiwan today. The pressure on Taiwan today is enormous as far as what the PRC is doing. But it has a blowback. Obviously, the people in Taiwan resent this. But now you have this seeping into, it's an important element of the most fundamental reevaluation of American-China policy in 40 years. This is happening, so the United States is picking up on this. And they see this as part of, what is this? This is a lot of this is United Front work, department activities, information operations, this kind of thing is going on throughout Taiwan. And Americans who see this say, well, this is happening here too, and they're very concerned about it. And it's part of the reevaluation of China policy, which is, and this is now facing Beijing. And so this assertiveness of Beijing and how they handle this thing is ham-handed, and it has a negative result, and I don't think it's going to work in the near term. And so the upside of this, the grand parade and the pressure on Taiwan to conform, I think is more negative than positive as an outcome for Beijing.